Production funding for Behind the Headlines is made possible in part by the WKNO Production Fund, the WKNO Endowment Fund, and by viewers like you. Thank you.
Frazier, the People's Convention, and more tonight on Behind the Headlines. Barnes with the Daily Memphian. Thanks for joining us. I'm joined tonight by a roundtable of journalists, starting with Jared Boyd with the Daily Memphian. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Bill Dries, also with the Daily Memphian. Thank you for being here. And Toby Sells is news editor with the Memphis Flyer. Thanks for being here again.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
We'll start in Frazier and kind of talk through maybe not some of what we've learned since, what we're trying to learn since what happened on, was it Wednesday night? We taped this Friday morning. So as of Friday morning, Bill, what is next with investigations, with next steps? And we'll kind of delve deeper and deeper. But what's next? Right.
The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation continues its investigation into the fatal shooting of Brandon Weber, who was being arrested by a federal task force for the U.S. Marshals Service for an accusation of a violent robbery in Mississippi. So that investigation continues. If it follows the pattern of past investigations, it will take quite some time for that to complete. In Frazier itself, as we taped this on a Friday morning overnight, Memphis police went to a different plan for coverage of that particular area and other parts of the city because of what happened on Wednesday evening. There were no one-man police cars. It's what is called a level three, two police officers to a car. Those kind of measures taken.
And there were no protests or reactions of note last night?
No.
Which was a big worry, right? I mean, mm-hmm. after what had happened and the protests and the tear gas and the rock throwing and everything that went,
right.
that went haywire on Wednesday.
Yeah. And reaction, meanwhile, it is growing from a number of different fronts. The national NAACP says it is watching the developments very closely. The Tennessee ACLU says it has some questions about why a federal task force was involved in coming here and all of this. There are expressions of concern. There are many questions about what happened in the initial incident and what has happened since then.
And Jared, you have a story up today about Frazier. You talked to a lot of community leaders in Frazier, and many of whom it seems said this is not fully indicative of who we are as Frazier.
Sure. Well, there was actually a Frazier Exchange Club meeting yesterday. A lot of media was there. I'm not sure how often media is attending, how often they are at meetings like that. I'm sure not often, so there was a reason we were there. And I think that the leaders who are typically at those meetings that are typically talking about business developments and community news, even things going on in the school system in Frazier, they invited us because they wanted a message to be clear and they wanted to stand in solidarity between pastors, people who work in nonprofit organizations in that neighborhood, and business owners and homeowners who are concerned. They wanted to make sure that they got out in front of this incident, and they wanted to make sure that they sent a clear message that Frazier isn't a community. At least they feel that Frazier is not a community that an incident like this is indicative of.
Yeah, it's a city, it's an area with a tremendous amount of pride. I mean, it's ironic that the governor was there earlier in the week,
the day before,
talking about a reentry program with convicts, talking about education, if I'm not mistaken.
Summer youth programs.
I mean,
in this specific area where this happened
right.
one day later.
Right. Sure. Toby, your thoughts on the week that was.
It was a sad kind of a crazy week, and I think the questions that are left behind are the ones that the ACLU put out in a statement on Thursday. It said, were attempts made at de-escalating or resolving the situation in different ways? And was shooting Mr. Weber over a dozen times, if reports are accurate, really necessary? And I think that's what we're all struggling with, the response to this. And also, as Bill said, you know, why were they there? To try to pick up this guy. And so we're left with a lot of stuff, and that's what we're going to have to deal with going forward.
One thing on that, since a number of us have brought that up, when that first came out that a U.S. Marshals task force was involved, it wasn't the local police. It came out, I believe it was yesterday, that the Hernando District Attorney, they were trying to pick up Brandon Weber on accusation of some charges. Is that right, Bill? And
yes.
That because it's across state lines, I mean, we sort of forget that because yeah. Mississippi's just right, 20 minutes down the road. It's mm-hmm. actually across state lines. So the U.S. Marshals, they were very serious, very horrifying accusations against this young man.
It was a violent robbery. Someone's car was taken from them. They were shot 5 times. However, there are instances where police departments contact another police department across state lines, and they work together on these kind of warrants being served without the use of a federal task force.
Yeah. And part of what is so hard to reconcile in this age of social media, I mean, you can see all kinds of information about Brandon Weber, the young man who was killed. You can see that he was he was a loved student at Central High School. He was a father. He had many friends and family members that are, and I don't know why I look at you or I can look at any of us, but I'll start with Jared. I mean, it is just so hard to reconcile what his friends and family are saying about him and the pain they obviously feel with what he is accused of doing prior to the shooting.
Well, I guess I have a bit of an interesting insight. One, just as a young man who came from a community who I think is pretty similar. But also, I spent a lot of time outside of Brandon's family home yesterday talking to his uncle and sort of gauging the mood of people who were mourning him in their own way. His uncle was very honest with me. Brandon was a straight A student and Brandon cared a lot about school, but Brandon lived in the streets mm-hmm. and Brandon had to have a pistol. And, he wasn't the type of kid that was dumb enough to, in his uncle's words, up his pistol at the sight of authority. But Brandon's uncle, his name was Carlos, felt like, this is a kid who needed to survive in that environment. And he also, shared with me that he felt a bit responsible because he thought that Brandon looked up to him in those circumstances. And he felt like he'd given that life up quite a while back, but he didn't express enough to Brandon that this was not the way to go.
So. I mean, there's a Facebook video, I think, it was on Brandon's Facebook page of him where he's selling some marijuana, and we linked to it from a story we did. Others may have as well. Obviously everybody in town has covered this. I don't want to just focus on the Daily Memphian. But his friend DeMichael Cole wrote a very painful, very heartfelt kind of remembrance of him that don't judge him, wait to learn more. Talked about, yeah, he may have sold drugs, but that was how he made money. It's a fascinating thing that we link to. It's on Medium by DeMichael Cole. Go ahead.
But that's one source of the discussion that is underway, because this becomes a process that has happened in every incident that is generally similar to this, where someone is killed by police or wounded by police. There is this process that mm-hmm. that takes place, and as a result, the person who is no longer there to defend themselves or to explain themselves becomes either or.
Yeah.
They become either the straight A student or they become the person who's the drug dealer. And I think if we're all honest with ourselves, we know that none of us are the extremes in our lives. We are a combination of all of those things.
And I think that process that Bill is talking about has become, it's sad, number one, that this has become a process, right? That we have to go through this enough times where we can kind of understand the rhythm of the episodes, but it is really heartening that we are humanizing these people and trying to look at all different facets of it. You've got a photo there that shows him as a father and a graduate and all those other things. But the Hernando Area District Attorney John Champion said that no doubt that they were dealing with a very violent person, and what he did was, it was awful. And the person that he shot 5 times is expected to make a full recovery. But he said they said that it wasn't something they just went down their roughshod into Memphis trying to find somebody, and this occurred. This was a violent felon who obviously did not want to go to jail. And, they ended up, from my knowledge, having to do what they had to do. And yeah. and that's so
that's
sad.
That's the DA at Hernando.
That's the DA in Hernando. And every bit of it is sad. And hopefully Something will change this time. I don't know.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see the coverage, and we've tried to do it. Other people, I mean, I used to get Commercial Appeal, you all, I mean, the TVs, people, the media, the coverage of crime and coverage of a big incident like this, to try to find that sort of struggle to get the news out there, but also to humanize, to not jump to conclusions. Mm-hmm. It looks like he's guilty. The police say he jumped out with it, you know, he rammed their vehicle and he had a gun. But, you know, I'm not saying anyone is deceiving. It's just sometimes the facts as they play out, it takes weeks, not hours, to figure out what really happened.
That's right.
It takes weeks, not hours, to figure out who these people involved really are. And that's just an interesting struggle that I think everyone's trying, all the media organizations to varying degrees are trying to, how do we have a bigger picture on what's going on, not the narrow, quick hit.
Exactly.
There are also a couple of things going on. There is, who is Brandon Weber? And then there are the questions about, okay, no matter who Brandon Weber was and what he was accused of, was this the right way for law enforcement to handle the situation?
Right. Well, a lot of the community members in Fraser and a lot of people who are outside of Brandon's home ask the same question, and it is why so often when a situation like this arises and it involves a young black man, it's always fatal force. So often we see that case. I think about, you know, Charlotte and the church shootings, why someone like Dylan Roof is able to be apprehended. That's mm-hmm. a very violent situation, but why so often young black men in similar situations are able to be brought in safely.
Mm-hmm. And I really hope during this episode, if there's anything that we take from this, I would love for Memphis to be the place that figures this out, the place that we can innovate, convene a task force, get people together to talk about our responses to stuff just like this. So whoever's out there and listening, boy, it would be really, really great if Memphis could put its stamp on this and say, we figured out how to do these situations better.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of a whole national dialogue. It's part of a national, I mean, this is not uniquely a Memphis incident in any sense whatsoever.
Well, in a perfect world, we just not have instances like this where, you know, people are in, you know, just violent situations and, you know, police don't have to respond in this way. You know, there's a bigger question about our youth and how we can keep them out of situations like this.
I mean, how, again, if you take the narrative at face value, how does a kid who is a great art student at Central High School, who is a great student, who did well on his ACT, who was enrolled in college, how is that reconciled with what he's accused of doing that led up to this?
And if you look at the area that this all took place in, the area where he died, there are so many other conflicting things going on. There are a number of churches in that area, as there are all across the city. There are a number of second chance programs there for ex-felons. There's also an apartment complex not too far from there, which is under one of the no gang injunctions.
Yeah.
So there's quite a mix of things going on in that community, and the terrain can change from one part, from one street to the next.
Well, it isn't, if I'm not mistaken, with Memphis 3.0, the strategic plan, isn't one of the anchor areas somewhere in or near Fraser,
yes.
Right? I mean, that the city and that whole planning process identified the importance and the historical importance of Fraser. The Firestone plant is very much on everybody's mind.
Right.
Can the city get a hold of the Firestone plant, which has been abandoned many years ago, and remediate it and do something with that would bring economic activity back to Fraser of some sort.
And this is the landscape in which this young man's life unfolded. And I think some of the discussion about this, you know, that personality is kind of forgotten. Those conflicts, those factors in his life are forgotten because he becomes a poster child for essentially both viewpoints here.
Yeah.
And just to kind of put a finer point on what I was saying earlier, Brandon Weber was innocent. He was never proven guilty in a court of law. But then on the flip side of that, if he was grabbing for a rifle and put officers' lives in danger, I wasn't there. I don't know how the situation went down. I'm not passing judgment on anybody, but it was just a sad episode.
Yeah. Well, one quick question. Will we have body camera footage? Do we know? Did the marshals do that?
Don't know about the marshals, the Memphis police.
Okay. I'm being told that they apparently do not.
So there's that.
Okay. I want to segue into, we talked about the People's Convention and the political season, because crime and all these things are they are political issues. They are what people look to their government leaders for. But I was going to read a couple of things that the Mayor Strickland had to say and one of his challengers, Tammy Sawyer, the county commissioner. Mayor Strickland, I'll just read a couple of quick things. I'm impressed by the professionalism and incredible restraint showed by the first responders as they endured concrete blocks being thrown at them, people spitting at them. The aggression toward our officers was unwarranted. He also said, though, and this he may have said to you, Bill, about Brandon Weber, the loss of one life is tragic, and I do grieve for the loss of this young man, and I grieve for his family. What next for the mayor, do you think? I mean, is the mayor said he was going to go to Fraser and meet with community leaders. Is that what's next, you think?
I think there will be ongoing dialogue about that. The Fraser Exchange Club meeting that Jared talked about is a weekly gathering that is kind of a place where all of the different organizations work and come together on a weekly basis and talk about that. And there are a lot of groups doing a lot of work in Fraser, and I believe that will be where the discussion starts.
Let me just quote from Tammy Sawyer. I believe most of this was on Twitter. She said, "I can't believe that move was made. This was about the tear gas, and we haven't focused as much on the police response. We talked some about the police response to the protesters that night. Don't judge Fraser," she said, this is Tammy Sawyer, "without asking the community how it feels to mourn their youth over and over again. What do people do with their pain and trauma when it gets to be too much, when a city has ignored them, when their loss is too great and they can no longer yell at the sky?" And that is Tammy Sawyer, who is also a county commissioner and is a prominent member of local political, the younger movement of politicians, and came out of kind of the protest movement, right? I mean, of Black Lives Matter and the bridge shutdown. I don't know who wants to take this. Does this incident play into the mayor's race that's right around the corner?
I think it does. I think that this conversation was inevitable as a part of the mayor's race, and I think it's now pretty much front and center in the race. There was always going to be a discussion about this as part of the mayor's race and as part of the city elections.
At that Fraser Exchange Club meeting, there were a lot of comments about, I remember one pastor spoke specifically to his disappointment with local leaders who didn't say enough in support of the community of Fraser and of the people who were outside hurting, and also just Weber's family, rather than, just giving their thoughts and their prayers and their feelings towards law enforcement, local law enforcement, which a lot of them were injured in this incident.
There was kind of an interesting discussion about that protest that night CNN called it a melee, and then the NAACP called it a riot on their Twitter page. And Tammy Sawyer said that the word riot distracts and distances people from the depth of what's occurring and allows them to turn their backs on the community expressing hurt. I think this is another step in that process that Bill was talking about earlier. How do we respond to it all, and what do we call it? I think those are interesting conversations happening now.
Yeah, and you mentioned it is a good thing. A number of community leaders who went there they got hit by rocks as well. Journalists, mm-hmm. I mean, got gas. There was tear gas. I think somebody from Channel 3 ended up being hospitalized. It turned out he was fine. But some 20-something first responders were injured. And so all that plays into this as well.
There was a lot going on in the crowd, in any crowd like that. So while there were people throwing bricks, there were also pastors who were telling people to go home at the same time.
Sure. We'll segue. I mentioned the People's Convention, Bill. Tell, for folks who don't know, what is the People's Convention? What was it, and how does that play into this mayor's race that we've been talking about, and maybe even the council races?
The People's Convention has been organized by Up the Vote. It began as kind of a successor to the 1991 African American People's Convention that was a key part of the process that made Willie Harrington the consensus challenger to Dick Hackett in the 1991 elections. This is a successor to that, obviously a different context for it, but it was organized by a group called Up the Vote 901, very much representative of the new generation of activism and political involvement that we've seen over the last 5 years or so. The gathering was at the Paradise Entertainment Center, what many people will know as formerly as Club Paradise. Drew a crowd of about 600 people, 200 of which voted electronically after hearing from candidates in different races who sought the convention's endorsement and a slate of candidates. It's not really a poll. It's a gathering of those who are politically involved who commit to do whatever they can to help get these candidates elected. And at the top of the ticket is County Commissioner Tammy Sawyer, who is among the challengers to Jim Strickland in the race at the top of this year's ballot, the race for mayor.
And am I right that Jim Strickland decided not to go, felt like it was kind of preordained that Tammy was going to win? I think former Mayor Harrington said the same thing.
Is that? Yes, okay. Yes.
I had
talked to him at the outset and said, okay, are you going to go? And he said, well, I'm going to seek any endorsement that I can get. But at that time, there was a pledge that the convention organizers scrapped later on where they were going to require the candidates to promise that they would withdraw from the race if they didn't get the People's Commission. He said, well, if that's in place, I probably won't go. Harrington said that he thought that it was impossible to repeat the importance of the 91 convention.
For those, the vote for mayor and council races is when? When does early voting start, give or take?
Early voting starts in mid-September.
So not that far
the election
away.
Day is October 5th, and the candidates have until noon of mid-next month to file their petitions.
Okay. Unless we'll move on to a couple other stories that you all have been working on as we segue out of politics and out of what happened in Fraser. One is on housing, and it's a strange segue, but I will own it that right now, I mean, there is even as this happened in Fraser, even as a prominent member of Glenn Coalfield was tragically killed in a random robbery, which we won't go into, but it was just a tragic and very upsetting thing for a lot of people. It was echoes of Filtranary. It felt random. It felt different. There's a lot of complicated issues beyond that and why it felt different. But against that is a booming economy in Memphis in many ways.
That's
and
right.
Housing is part of that.
And the story that's on the racks on the flyer today, it's called Boomtown, and it is, according to some numbers I looked at, more than $14 billion of investment in Memphis since 2014, either finished, underway, or in the pipeline. And you can see it all over town. You can see we don't have the cranes like downtown Nashville has, because our boom is a little bit different. You know, we kind of go in and we renovate, and we do those things kind of the Memphis way. But that boom has a lot of people worried that we will turn out to be like a city like Nashville, where home prices are insane and traffic is crazy. But everybody I talked to didn't seem to think we're really heading down that way. Home prices are up just slightly, rents are up just slightly, and it seems like there's going to be room for everybody here. But it is exciting when you get out there and you see these developments happening all over the place. And one other growing pain out of that is some of these developers, they'll go into a classic Midtown neighborhood and kind of put up a new modern looking building. And it really sets the historic preservationist people on edge. And it's just a part of the growing pains we're going through.
Yeah. And you've got, I mean, interesting, like in Cooper Young, you've got interesting issues of kind of a kind of gentrification. You've got mm-hmm. streets where you've got houses that are being renovated and listed for $300,000 plus that are right next to houses that have been held and owned by families forever that are probably worth $50,000. And that, that process is interesting to watch too. But the other part is you did a story last week on a kind of historic building
sure.
that is in the in this boomtown mix.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we think of Beale Street as a historic street, but in my lifetime, I was born right in sort of the onset of this revitalization of Beale Street. I was born in the early 90s, and so this association that we have of it as a center of good times wasn't always, my experience mm-hmm. or the experience of the people around me. But 380 Beale, which starting this story, I had almost no clue just how important its early history was as a cinema and how it related to Muhammad Ali and his involvement in that development, was one of the sort of first new buildings, Bill, if I'm correct, to sort of set off some of these things that
before the new district.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And over the years, especially even in my days in high school, it was a nightclub, and it was a place that people could go for high school parties, college parties, these sorts of things, because it was being rented out. But it was definitely a dangerous place, and even in my days, it was thought of as sort of the older hip hop club. It was mm-hmm. it wasn't as nice as some of the ones in Parkway Village and Hickory Hill, so on and so forth. But it is an epicenter and a mecca of some of these things that we think of today. There would be no 36 Mafia and an Oscar without 380 Beale first. And there would be no global understanding of what juking is if there was not a 380 Beale first. And so when you talk about Memphis and music tourism, which is a big part of this Boomtown thing, it's sort of that's one big element of it. Where does hip hop fit into that? Where is the place that we can go and see a plaque? The same way that you can go to the Chiska Hotel and hear about Dewey Phillips, or you can go to Sun Studios, you can go to Graceland, you can go to Soulsville and see Stax, or you could go to Willie Mitchell Boulevard and visit Royal. Where does hip hop fit in that conversation? How do we move our musical tapestry forward?
So. Yeah. Will you tell the quick story of Muhammad Ali fighting Willie Harrington, Mayor Harrington?
No, actually it was Congressman Harold Ford Sr.
That's right.
But yeah, Muhammad Ali, as Jared turned up in his research on the story, was originally a part owner of the theater. It was originally a movie theater in the 1970s. So Muhammad Ali came to town and did an exhibition boxing match. He was still boxing at the time. And so Congressman Harold Ford Sr. got in the ring with him. And his son, Congressman Harold Ford, future Congressman Harold Ford Jr., was by the ring and kind of saw his dad getting beaten up and jumped into the ring and started taking on Muhammad Ali.
My mind is blown again.
There we go. Yeah. That is all. I love that story. I think we've told it before, but it's a great story and a great history. Thank you all for being here to talk about a tough subject. And thank you for listening. Join us again next week.